them guns with the aircraft.
I have never touched the control of an airplane. And my reason there was that a number of the graduate students who would come up had pilot's licenses. And there was a desire to go ahead and fly. And I had a strict rule that they could not touch the controls of an airplane. And my feeling was that if I didn't, there was absolutely no reason that they could claim any rights to touch the plane. I wanted to have very strict conditions for the planes. For instance, at one time, we had four pilots and an aircraft mechanic who was also a pilot, but that had a total of 66 years of flying experience and 64,000 hours in the air. I mean, tremendous numbers. And for instance, I would not even consider a pilot with less than 1,500 hours. Mm-hmm. And so that there were certain things that I figured that had to be very strict on. For instance, I had absolute control of the aircraft and boats, because with those things, you can kill people. And so that in my presence, not even John would give an authorization for an aircraft. If I were to be away, then the whole authority transferred, but there were never two cooks messing with the soup in those two areas. And it was, in effect, anybody that sort of verged away from some of the strict rules in that regard didn't get the opportunity for a second violation. And as a result, on occasion I was called a dictator. And I always corrected by adding the word benevolent. Never any other change. Any other things that you...
Yeah, well, the other thing I'm interested in is the natives working so closely with the scientists. Mm. And I know you said you always made sure there was a native along on all the field projects, and that seems quite advanced for its time period. And I'm wondering, you've written about, you know, talked about how much you learned from the natives, and Dr. Irving did with Simon Pontiac, and Tom Albert always credits Harry, but that seems a rare thing in the scientific community, is it?
I think that it's rare unless the people have been there a long time. And for instance, Jess Walker was very much in tune with that approach. He had spent a lot of time with the Woods. Job Woods was his field assistant for many seasons. And I used to send people out to, you know, if they wanted a study that where the Colville Delta was a good place, I would send them out where and have them set up their tents near the George and Nonnie Woods. Mm-hmm. And then would work closely, for instance, for years for the animals. I bought much of the Woods production of fish. Mm-hmm. I provided them with things that were somewhat hard to get. Of course, the fish, that was out and out purchase. But I know that in Onaktuvik Pass, they're kind of take care of the watching the cabin, and we didn't have people in sight. John Hugo did that for me. And what I would do is I would, when the plane would go in, I made sure that it was, shall we say, well supplied with tea, coffee, canned milk, and sugar. And I know Nick Gubser, who actually wrote the what is considered a famous book on it too. Nick was an honors student at Yale between his junior and sophomore and senior years. He came up a barrel, so he went in. So I wanted him to sort of be able to talk to people, not questioning. For instance, any interviews I discouraged very strongly, and always suggested that, well, it's better to talk, not interview. And I was totally against any pain or interviews. And so that I would send the stuff in, and I would brief them as to how I would go about their study, if I was going to do it, and then sort of supply them accordingly. And for instance, I remember one of the administrative assistants, one time I was in the resupply to Onaktuvik. I wanted another case of tea. Not a box of tea, I wanted a case. He says, I've figured up you've sent enough tea in Onaktuvik to make 10 barrels this winter. And I said, well, that's good. And, of course, Vic came out with a fabulous study. Sometimes he stayed with Simon and his son. Sometimes in the old tent. So, I heard good things about Nick Matthew. And he came in, talked to me. He had another 2 weeks work before he had to go back to Yale. And I asked him, I said, have you ever thought about spending a winter? Ending your studies for a year. Oh, he said, I dearly love it. But he said, I can't get a grant in time. So I said, well, would you like to do it, huh? So, I was that meeting. I didn't know. I hadn't told him that he had a grant for another year's work in Anaktuvik if he wanted to stay there. And if he wanted to stay, just unpack his bag and stay. He said he'd load the foodstuffs. He spent a year, another year. He graduated. Yeah. Wrote to me. Said he was applying for Strode scholarship. And I gave him recognition. I did. And he went to Cambridge for a couple of years. Got his PhD. Studied. Went out to do field work in Ethiopia. His parents were here since Christmas. And so that type of thing. When you see a good one, then you want to dangle in front of them the possibility, well, maybe. Like Hal Payton used to. And now, but 57, the science conference, he had some gave a paper, you know, to what he'd like to do, freshwater rights. Friend worked for me, actually, Mrs. Lemon was here. Both of us were intrigued with what Hal wanted to do. So we had it over a drink. I said, Hal, have you ever thought of studying CS? No. He hadn't thought of it. And went on to what he wanted to do with freshwater ice. I said to him, well, how are you coming with grant money? He said, I've applied everywhere for the last 6-9 months. Can't get any support. Well, I said, have you ever thought of applying to places for the same kind of study in sea ice? No, I want to do it in Russia. I don't know, I'm getting the grant. About the third time, I said, well, is there any place I can get a grant to do the work on sea ice? Where he might get the grant, because he wanted a good chunk of money. Six weeks later, he and his family are in Maryland. He's working on sea ice. And he's the one, the monopods here in Cook Inlet, he eventually ended up designing those. He was one of the chief scientists on the construction of the Dua. Or doing the pipeline and whatnot, studies of ice. So that he had the usual or something, are you going to do different?
Well, I can do different tonight if you want.
Well, what do you want?
The usual. Only.
Okay.
That's okay. I'm curious about this separation of lab and town.
Yeah, but for instance, Chandler's and Brewer's play bridge. Of course, you know, you can only play in one house, so that there was a babysitter in the other. Mm-hmm. And so I'd go over, and John and his daughter would go pick up the babysitter. And
oh, you are a pot. You better eat that.
Then we would play bridge, and it might be 1 or 2 in the morning when we were done. And we'd take the babysitter home afterwards. Well, then we'd make a circle in the village to see if, shall we say, everything was quiet on the western front.
There were stray vehicles from the camp in there.
And so.
In those days, it was pretty easy. There weren't many wheels around.
So we'd make the trip. And I remember one night in particular that we were over and caught the manhole in the village. As you know, no keys on the vehicles in those days. So
I think they had keys on them. We just never took them off.
Well, okay. The thing was, we caught this one fellow who I'd had a problem or two with before. And I told him in no uncertain language to get back in camp. And he was giving me, shall we say, some objections. And it was Silas had a...
Thank you. I've been trying to remember his name.
That came around in the Al's coffee shop.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. There
well,
in,
it was a different place.
Yeah. But, here came Silas. And Silas never spoke much English. And he came around, and Silas had found a place where it wasn't so dry, because he was in pretty good shape. Anyway, he came up. Max, if he gives you a bad time, I kill him, I kill him.
Beat him up.
Yeah, and so, and of course, the fellow got in the manhole went back to camp. And the next day, I called him in, explained the error of his ways, and told him that he was through at Barrow to be on the plane. And so he departed Barrow. His major professor down south, who had a certain amount of stroke with the Navy, complained bitterly that I had, well, there were others, but I'd been a little high-handed, and so he complained to the Navy. The Navy never answered him. And the fellow never came back. And when at the lab in those days, let's face it, if you wanted to eat, sleep, or have a vehicle,
you had to stay on his good side. He was a tyrant.
I had control.
As he said, he was a benevolent dictator. It's his favorite line.
And, he was not the only one that...
Who was that one?
Ever went...
I can't remember.
Stroshine.
Yeah. We have some old NARA files, mm-hmm. Barrow, that actually I pulled out of the dump.
Uh-huh.
And in there was some paper letters or correspondence, whatever, relating to somebody who had taken a weasel without authorization and gone to town. And that's the first I came across that that wasn't supposed to happen, and I don't remember the name on it at all, but...
Oh, yeah, this was a big no-no. That was in the 60s.
Uh-huh.
And later on, Lord, the traffic back and forth was ridiculous.
Yeah.
And the booze... Yeah. No booze to the village.
If you took booze to the village, it was automatic firing.
Yep.
No questions asked.
And
did villagers come to...
To the camp?
At the camp?
Occasionally.
For instance, Christmas parties?
Oh, yeah.
We had beer.
That side of the celebration. And they used to sneak out for nothing, too, and sometimes pick up some beers. And stuff.
But, you know, that they got on their own. Another thing is, for instance, in the late 60s, when people were starting to be a little political, they, or like when a senator or somebody was coming to Barrow, and the village wanted to hold a reception for the senator, they would ask if they could hold the reception at the lab. Mm-hmm. In other words,
so they didn't serve liquor in the village.
People could come to the lab, and liquor was okay. It's just that any liquor that you carried to the village had better be in your stomach. And that was just sort of the way in certain respects was being a little bit puritanical, not as puritanical as the Navy was at one time, but it was being a little bit on the puritanical side. But we were living in an area where, in effect, there were two cultures.
Yeah, it was a different world.
And one culture, the people, for instance, the people in camp were transients. And they weren't appreciative, necessarily, of the other culture. Whereas the people in the village, they'd had more association, and so they understood. And it's like, you know, like they'd call up, for instance, Eben Hobson would call up and say somebody was coming in that they would like to have a reception for him. Occasionally, they would even ask us to host it. In other words, we furnished the booze.
Yeah.
And but this was, and they were never refused. But it was.
I think my favorite story about going to the village concerns the Navy kid who thought I think they got lectures before they came up that the sun rose, set, and went around and responded to his orders, you know, because they were really. And this kid had, I can't think of a nicer way to say it, but had the hots for some young child in the village. And he got a ride over and spent the night, I don't know. But at least he walked back at about 2 o'clock in the morning. What is it, 4.5 miles?
No, not quite 4.
Anyway, he was wearing Levi's, and it was 20 below. And he was so badly frostbitten on the inside of his legs that he was dazed in bed just doing this. Nothing was ever said. We figured he had been punished enough.
It was just reward.
That was Gary's side, remember? Yeah.
Didn't he run the animal?
That was somebody else. That was Gary Larson. Gary Sides was a... He worked for the Navy, and somehow or other, I think, did he stay as a civilian?
We hired him.
Yeah. But he came up Navy originally,
But...
He was a nice guy. He really was a very nice person.
Yeah.
I can still see him lying there with all the blisters on the insides of his leg.
Well, he's damn lucky that he survived, because, you know, it used to be, for instance, when the Air Force would, or the Army would send some GIs up, they occasionally had a project. Mm-hmm. And invariably, a tall, lanky types. And most people don't know it. But the major blood vessels that are close to the surface are right here.
On your knee?
Yeah, and in the jugular. And so that people would come up, and I would explain to them, and I would tell them, now, if you go to wade an icy stream wider than 50 feet, I'll bet that you never make it. And
Well, we're gonna tell stories on your father.
The other thing is that I would tell them about being out, and see, most of the GIs wore fatigues. There's no insulation. We wore insulated pants up there. And some wore the, you know, long johns and such, but after the first year I never did. But they would go ahead, and I would warn them about it. And actually, at some of the outposts in Alaska in those days, one or two every winter, GIs would go out, and they would walk it, because young fellows are always tougher than oldsters. And so the thing is, but when the blood temperature drops in most people to about 92 or 3, you pass out. And that, in fact, that if you can take an anesthetic, if they take and run your blood through a refrigerator and drop your blood temperature, they can commit surgery, major surgery,
if they lower your blood temperature,
without ever giving you an anesthetic.
Huh. Well, that's another story we should tell here. There are two opposite ends of the scale in this room. We had, is that Fred Milan's room?
Yeah.
It was Eric Carroll, I can't remember if it was Fred's or not. Came up to check on reactions to cold and to see if Eskimos could tolerate more cold than white people could tolerate. And so they put these thermistors on people's hands, and then they go stick them out in cold.
And they stick them in cold water?
Most of this was just, they wet them and just stick them out in the air. Mm-hmm. And see how quickly they would rewarm.
Because
how low would the body allow the temperature to go before it pumped more blood and rewarm them? And they really had everything down pat. They thought they had a great study. Then out of courtesy, they asked if we would submit to the test. I rewarmed at the highest temperature they'd ever seen, and he rewarmed at the lowest temperature they ever seen.
In other words, natives are supposed to rewarm at a higher temperature.
Yeah. But we really screwed up the record.
He rewarmed at the highest.
I rewarmed higher than natives.
Than a native. And I rewarmed lower than whites, and our chief pilot, who was not tested, but I swear to this day, Bobby Fisher, senior, that he must have rewarmed at the highest temperature, because at 20 below, refueling a Cessna, he could take a 5-gallon gas can and
sit out there on the wing in the wind and
pour it, barehanded.
I can still see Bobby doing it. Say, put on your gloves!
And he didn't want to get him contaminated. But, I mean, he was fantastic that way.
See, I would have messed up their study, too, because my hands get cold really fast. Yeah. Take a long time to warm up.
I warm up immediately. My hands never really go down to cold.
And on top of that, he didn't weigh as much in those days.
No, I was a lot skinnier in those days.
But
it's very interesting.
No, it you know, in the way, what it used to be called cake eater on the way to the gas well.
Yeah,
I explained. That's the word I didn't use.
What?
Cake eater is where the antenna farm was.
Yeah.
It's all, now the whole gas well road is referred to as cake eater road.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, when you used to drive out the gas well road on the left-hand side, just before you got to that
The ravine.
Both slew.
Wolschlag slew. I told
no,
you.
No, both.
Well, that's both. Yeah,
Wolschlag is on the coast.
Further up, yeah. Anyway, I told her about Tommy and Kate. Tommy proposed to Kate.
The waterfall.
Waterfall. But anyway, that was Cake Eater. The antenna was the Cake Eater project.
Oh, okay. That's where that name comes from.
That's where the name came from. It was an Air Force project with over-the-horizon radar.
Why the name Cake Eater?
No, the thing is, the military always has a code name.
Yeah, it was a military
code. And see, this was classified. What it was is they were bouncing radar between Barrow and Greenland.
Over the horizon.
And it was for over the horizon. For instance, at the laboratory, I insisted that no project ever be classified at the lab, although we had classified projects. And I told him, I said, in the Arctic, there are no secrets. In the summertime, it's light all the time. And in the wintertime, you leave tracks. So there are no secrets up there. And as a result, I refused. And this is, you know, the Navy was paying the bills. They were the big boss. Mm-hmm. And so I told them, the Navy would send classified projects, you know, and they'd want, well, classified, I said, fine, you tell what you want and whatnot, but no classification once between the old and new in any culture, there's a gap. And, for instance, among the older natives, they may not speak English so well, or be aware of some of the customs, but they're secure in their culture. And you take those that are coming along now, the culture has changed so that they can be secure in the culture as it exists now. But those who, the generation in between, that have a foot in each culture, really lack security, because they could not go out and really live like their fathers could. And yet they are handicapped in the existing culture. Mm-hmm. So that they have no real security. And as a result, they're more prone to some of the problems of both cultures. And to some degree, that can explain some problems with alcohol.
Yeah.
Not all. Because Arctic-wide, the further north you go, not only do you have the more gaudy paint schemes on the outside of houses, but you also have the most problems with alcohol, the most problems with depression, and that sort of thing. Because it starts to get you down. And this is one of the things that I found. For instance, the games at Barrow, Christmas, New Year's week. I mean, it's you're just going downhill. And then you get into the games, and then after the first of the year at Barrow, you know, gee, it's lighter each day, and it comes fast.
Mm-hmm.
Even though spring's 5 months away, your spirits can pick up. Well, if you study the cultures worldwide, where there is a change in culture, you run into sort of similar set of circumstances. And that, and I used to try to explain this to educators because here, in of my cousin's generation, for instance, I was the, among the younger of my first cousins, but the first one to ever get a college degree. And so that when I was growing up, it wasn't, you know, just common conversation, well, when you go into college and this, that, and the other. When my kids were growing up, you know, the idea of going to college, this was part of the conversation. Well, what are you going to do? And you got to save money for this, that, and the other when you go to college. In other words, it was part of the aspect of essentially what was expected.
Right.
Well, you take the kids at Barrow growing up. There was a gap between a few grades of school and completing high school. Even then there's another generation and the gap between, well, high school and college. So that you have two gaps there for from the educational standpoint. And you can try to bridge it. But the bridge is difficult. And it's, for instance, this friend in China. Oh, his brother. And his brother got in under the wire of the one child family.
Mm-hmm.
So that in that family there were actually a girl and two boys. And now, it's one child. And it's very, very serious about it, except in the outlying areas or in some of the minority areas, because there are 85 ethnic groups in China,
wow.
About 120 in the old Soviet.
Hmm.
And they have their problems in that regard. For instance, this friend from the peasant class, and I tried to equate, well, my father was a farmer, but there is a difference between a peasant and a farmer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even speaking of a rich farmer. And so and there is that gap there in the education. And it's the, of course, with the Asian group, there is more of a grasp at education because there's more recognition that is the potential salvation. We don't have that here in the Alaskan population.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's a general thing. In some cases, yes. But not as a general rule. So you do have things that that come in there, and it's something like it's difficult to do much about, but the recognition of what the problem is makes life much easier from the standpoint of frustration. And you don't get all tangled up and as to the frustrations and, in fact, sometimes anger at things that being the way they are. Just makes it a nicer setup for living. Well, maybe we could hit the stop button.
The one question I've tried to ask everybody who I've been talking to about Harry is, when you think about him, what do you think is important about his life for other people to know, and why I should be doing this life history of him?
In the old culture, the people were not strict disciplinarians. It was by example and gentle persuasion. It takes sophistication to adopt that approach. But it is an approach that is lasting. For instance, when you consider the survival of people in that type of environment for probably at least about 12,000 people. Or 12,000 years. It was a case of survival of the fittest. And until some of the problems of recent years, you had a rendition there of the best over the centuries. This is of the people. In Harry's case, it was example and gentle persuasion. What you may not recognize is that although Harry was the youngest boy of the third family, Harry ended up being the patriarch of the third family. For instance, when there were family arguments, and I have reason to believe that some of them were pretty heated, it was Harry who would finally say, "It is this way." Now, for the youngest boy in the family to command the respect of his siblings, who knew all his weaknesses, it says quite a bit for the person's character and integrity. And I think that his example is carried on and remembered by people because they do remember. It's probably his greatest legacy. Those who didn't know him won't have the benefit of his sly humor or the grin, or how, with all his medical problems over the years, and he did have a lot of them. Of course, the cause of him being in his physical makeup, but sometimes in the errors of others who tried to treat him and left things inside him that they had to go out and go and fish out later because they were causing him such distress that Harry never blamed. It was the, and I think that with his kids, that you can see that. I mean, for instance, Harry's kids have been remarkably free of problems. And the kids have, they are nice people to know. Some I know a bit better than others, like Ron, Harry Jr., of course, known Eugene, the longest of the boys, but there, I think, is a lot of the answer. With great respect shown for him. And when you consider that among his siblings there were some very strong-willed people. For instance, Sadie and Tommy. Mm-hmm. Quite strong-willed folks. And with great respect for Harry. But he was a teacher. And that came through.
Of all your experiences with Harry, and I know you have a lot, and probably a lot of stories about him, are there some you can think of that are just so typical Harry?
Oh, I think that the one about the polar bear and the cubs, that was a typical Harry. They trying to clean the fox skins and the automatic washer. That sort of thing. And then his other remarks, for instance, and the care, for instance, when I'm not sure as to how much schooling Harry actually had. I think it was 7th or 8th grade, but I'm not positive. And yet, in his taxidermy, where he would record the various statistics about the bird or the animal that he was preparing, he was more meticulous than most graduate students who had the chore of doing that. Harry would just do it as part of the information. He'd picked up that, well, people like to have this sort of information, so very meticulous. His approach to carpentry, where he was a finished carpenter. He was not a rough carpenter that, well, just, you know, something that'll do. Another thing, like, for instance, his concern there about Eunice, you know, when he recognized that, well, she wanted to go to school, and here was a situation, you know, that where he knew that it would be years before he'd see her again, and his concern about it to bring to my attention, and I just happened to be sitting in the right spot, and the conditions were just right that I could go ahead and do something about it and make it look like a home run. But that sort of thing, you know, that's the luck of the draw and of timing. But there, you could tell there that the depth of the man. And that's what his family saw in him, the depth of the man. Because here the kid brother bringing the rest to heel when it came to what was right and proper. Any other questions?
Yeah, another one is, I remember Harry talking about one time when there was an accident out spring whaling, a boat flipped over, and they pulled up guys from the water. And the assistance that the lab provided, helicopter or something, and it may have happened more than once. I'm thinking of one case he told me about. Do you remember that, or other? Talk about that a little bit.
I remember Pete's son, Floyd. And Floyd was the tallest of Pete's boys. And he was about 16. And he came down and talked to me, and then he went down to see Mary Lou. And she was sleeping. It was just before Karen was born. And she was getting ready to go down south. Because she has Rh negative.
Oh.
So we had that problem, because in those days, the only thing in Alaska that could handle that was Radfield, now mm-hmm. Fort Wainwright. And Boyd came down, Mary Lou was asleep. So he sat down and played with Bill, who would have been three. And he went out. John took a pallet to get across the moat to the ice. Apparently it flipped over. He drowned in 4 feet of water. And I know when we got him out that we tried to revive him and couldn't. But situation that you refer to doesn't strike a bell, because although we had the little helicopters when we were when I was at the lab, we never really flew them in support of programs. But I do know that the year that Harry got three whales, and I think it was in 1875, how proud he was for the fact that his entire crew were his sons. And that that meant a great deal to him, because I never knew Arnold to be, you know, although Arnold was the the great subsistence hunter. I never knew him to be sort of in the whaling business. The gifted, the people at the lab gave me when I left, was whaling gun in beautiful condition. Taking its first whale in 1878. Its last whale in the spring of 71, just before they gave it to me.
Wow.
It had been owned by Waldo Bodfish.
Wow.
And I knew that Kenny wanted to go to a lot of places. He was, stopping here and there. I didn't have the foggiest notion of anything. But Kenny was scouring from Point Hope and Kotzebue to demarcation point to get a whaling gun for me. And this was Waldo Bodfish's whaling gun, and Kenny wanted to buy it from him, and Waldo didn't want to sell it. And then Kenny told him what he wanted it for. And Waldo said, okay.
So, do you remember the lab helping the whalers with things? Either accidents or whatever else?
Shall we say, once ashore, a bit of assistance for the fall, really. Then we had one investigator, Floyd Durham, from California, went out, and people would be cutting away, and of course, Floyd was out to get information on the internal aspects of the whales. And the people really thought that here was a man that was going the extra mile, because they said he'd crawl in the whale. And unwilling, because of the fact that whales were protected. The lab was careful not to infringe. Now, the aspect that did we arrange, so that people could have time off to go whaling or this, that, and the other. I mean, we were very cooperative with the people's desire. And in the case of walrus, I know one time when the walrus were out, I loaned them the boat we had, the Natchick and the Ivic. And the Ivic was a smaller boat. And inboard engine. And we had an investigator who wanted some tissue. So on Sunday, I said, if the fellows wanted to borrow the boat, they could go along. And of course, the fellow went along and they got each little pieces of tissue, very fresh. And then in the we used to do our cat training in winter. And so I would have a winter chore like maybe hauling Wanigan somewhere. And it would just happen to be at a fortuitous time for caribou to be available. The other thing is that I had a permit that allowed me to take anything at any time of year for scientific purposes, with the exception of polar bear, walrus, and whale. But anything else, this for scientific purposes, I could take. And after receiving that permit the first time, I have never again fired a gun. Because the thing that I felt was that if I actually went out and took something, then there was always a question as to whether or not I was indulging in a sport. And so that with the permit, what I did is, and I would do it in writing, is that I would reassign. And very often it was to a reassignment to Pete. To do the collecting. And for instance, the lab had a couple polar bears that were taken in 66. Mm-hmm. And in those days, it was a sacrifice of the sow. And so it, I sent the two aircraft out. And to get a couple of cubs, and Pete was the one who actually did the taking of the bear.